Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, bringing you on through another edition of this wonderful program where we talk about health, wellness, and issues in alternative medicine today. Today we have a guest on, an author of a book called The Wild Medicine Solution, Healing with Aromatic, Bitter, and Tonic Plants. And his name is Guido Mas. Is it Masse or Mas?
I say Masse.
Masse. Okay. How you doing, Guido? Yeah. Nice to have you on.
Doing well.
Okay. So, you know, I'll read the back of this book. It's very interesting. As people moved into cities and suburbs and embraced modern medicine and industrialized food, they lost their connection to nature, and particularly the plants with which humanity co-evolved. These plants are essential components of our physiologies. Excuse me. Usually I try to do that before the show, but anyway. and biochemistry and herbalist Guido Mas explores the three classes of plants necessary for the healthy function of our bodies and minds: aromatics, bitters, and tonics. He goes over how bitter plants ignite digestion, balance the blood sugar, buffer toxicity, and improve metabolism, how the tonic plants normalize the functions of our cells and nourish the immune system, and how the aromatic plants, those are the ones with the volatile oils or aromatic oils, relax tense organs, nerves, and muscles and stimulate sluggish systems, whether physical, mental, or emotional. So, welcome to the program, and let's start talking about your very fascinating book. What prompted you to write this book, Guido?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. It's great to be here. And the reason I wanted to put some of this info together, I'm an herbalist by trade, and I've been doing this work for, 15-plus years here in central Vermont, which is very rich in medicinal plants. But I also started work at a natural food store, and a lot of folks I work with on a daily basis shop at natural food stores, and they're very conscious about local organic food and whole food. But at the same time, I saw them purchasing lots and lots of supplement pills, which often are manufactured far away and tend to kind of be the opposite of a whole food, whole plant solution. And being an herbalist, I'm a whole plant guy. I really believe in the power of whole foods, but I also believe in the power of whole medicine. And this is kind of what human beings have been doing for thousands of years. So I wanted to try and distill the best of what herbal medicine has to offer, which is a really rich and complex art, into something that was really approachable, understandable, and would kind of give us a way forward in the whole medicine world, something that used whole plants, very unprocessed, very easy to find, very safe, and that gave us a little bit of a way out of this endless chase for the next supplement.
Tell us a little bit about how you became an herbalist. Everyone has a unique background. I ended up not only becoming an herbalist, but I decided to take the plunge and become a naturopathic physician and get involved with other disciplines besides herbs. But, my original draw to a profession such as that was actually botanical medicine and herbal medicine.
Yeah, and I grew up in Italy, and I lived there till I was about 14, a little bit kind of in the middle of the Alps, which is a sort of a very beautiful and unique ecosystem. A lot of our medicinal plants come from there, like arnica, for instance, mm-hmm. or native there. And when I moved to this country, my mom is American, and we did a little bit of back and forth as I was growing up, but I kind of relocated here permanently when I was about 14, 15. I was a high school kid, and I just kind of did my thing. But after a few years, I recognized that, these medicinal plants that we were using as part of the culture in Italy were largely absent from the American culture. And started wondering why that was, and that was kind of in the back of my mind. My studies, what I was interested in, revolved around a couple of fields that seemed at the time very, very disparate. And one was sort of spiritual and religious culture study, Eastern and Western mythology, and then also organic chemistry and biochemistry on the other side of things, which kind of, were pulling me in two separate directions for a long time. until I realized that in herbal medicine, which was this part of, you know, my childhood that I really was starting to miss, you could find a way to bridge the gap between sort of the modern biochemical understanding of the human body and the traditional mythological, mythopoetic understanding of the human being and the human culture and ecology. It was really neat for me to be able to see how talking about a plant like hawthorn berry, for instance, you could have a pretty detailed biochemical understanding of its effects, but at the same time have pages and pages of folklore and story and myth and magic associated with it too. And so that's what really kind of cemented in me the idea that botanical medicine was where I wanted to go, this beautiful, rich track record of folklore and this very good sort of modern biochemical scientific research basis.
Right.
So I proceeded to travel around the country and learn from plant people as much as I could. And then I was lucky enough that my wife, like 12 years ago, decided to kind of start the pre-med and medical school path. And I had access to our local medical library at the university and was able to study biochemistry alongside her and really cement my knowledge in that field, too.
Fascinating. Tell us about your first chapter in your book, A Cuisine for Medicine. Kind of summarize it for the listeners, because it kind of draws them into a philosophical and historical, background of which sets the stage for your book.
Yeah, and thanks for putting it that way. That's exactly what I was trying to do, was kind of give an overview as to why we can narrow herbal medicine down to these three important sort of areas of activity, the aromatic, bitter, and tonic plants. So a cuisine for medicine is basically the idea of, do we have something like cuisine, which is this sort of historical and cultural background for how we cook, right? Do we have something like that for medicine, where we have something that's embedded in culture, something that generally uses whole foods and whole plants, but that has an eye towards preventing and treating disease rather than just, you know, keeping us well fed? And obviously the line is kind of blurry, because a couple thousand years ago the pharmacy and the kitchen were basically the same thing. But nowadays they've become a little bit separate. So that's the question. Is there a cuisine for medicine? Is there something that is well-rooted, traditional, historic, and accessible, something that we can do in our kitchen the same way we cook? And my thought is that the traditional plant-based systems of healing that you see on every continent in the world are basically this. They are the cuisine for medicine. Botanical medicine is this kitchen-based approach to preventing and treating disease that is embedded in the culture much the same way cuisine is embedded in the culture in terms of nourishing ourselves. But it uses these plants that are not really food-like, right? They're bitter, they don't have a lot of caloric value, they may be pungent and spicy like some of the aromatics are, but, you know, they're not really going to give us the calories we need. But yet human beings have been using them forever. You know, they've scraped Neanderthal teeth and they've found residues of plants like yarrow, which isn't a food plant at all, but yet people were still using them. So the thought is that herbal medicine has this historical piece to it that is very cuisine-like. But then, because herbal medicine is so complex and there's so many different approaches around the world, I wanted to try and distill it out into something that was similar across all of the sort of botanical medical systems of the planet. And in order to do that, I kind of had to get into this concept of systems theory or network theory, which is a very novel, relatively speaking, branch of science. Over the last 20, 30 years, this understanding of how to bring complexity down into something that can be tamed, rather than by looking at the individual pieces, by looking at the network of interaction of all its components. So again, instead of trying to describe a city in terms of, you know, each individual house and where it's located on a grid, we more talk about, you know, areas where people live, and then areas where people shop, and areas where people work, and the flows of traffic between them. That's a systems-based understanding of an urban environment, for instance. And what we find is that the human physiology also has these sort of key areas, like places where work and eating and living take place, that are very central and important to the functioning of the human body. And if we can address those places with some of these elements from botanical medicine, what we'll find is it will prevent some of the most crucial and sort of damaging imbalances that Western culture has as its hallmarks. Things like mental health issues, digestive problems and toxicity, and also things like cardiovascular inflammation that connects to heart disease and inflammation that connects to cancer. And so a cuisine for medicine kind of sets the stage for that. It's like we can break down the complexity of botanical medicine and the complexity of the human physiology, and we'll find that there's really a few key areas where the two intersect in very profound and, I think, beautiful fashion. And if we address those areas, then we can have dramatic impacts without necessarily having to get into, a lifetime of learning as to how to address those things.
Fascinating. And then you move on into the next chapter where you're starting to talk a little bit about aromatics. So we're moving into the use of aromatic plants and how they were used to not only drive away evil spirits, but they were, you bring up, I'm also a Catholic, and I remember, sacred rituals, like when my grandmother passed away or whatnot, burning the frankincense and myrrh, and they used a lot of the herbs for sacred rituals across the continents. But then you start talking a little bit about the use of these particular plants as antiseptics and carminative. So maybe you can go through for the listeners a little bit about aromatics and then give us some great examples of them.
Yeah, and I really appreciate the connection to the Catholic Church. I definitely was steeped in the Catholic Church when I was growing up too, and you see the use of aromatic plants all the time, especially the frankincense. Right. But that's what really got me thinking. I'm an herbalist, and so I've used plants for the nervous system all the time. That's one of the major complaints of folks who walk into my office, as probably you've seen in your practice too. People feel anxious or they feel sluggish and depressed and out of it. It's unfortunately a big part of today's culture, and I think it's one of the things that we have to live with such a high, fast-paced, go, 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 24-hour news cycle kind of world, which is fine. But what we don't have quite as much of are these daily rituals and ceremonies that I think people have been turning to forever. If we had been part of the Catholic Church even a couple hundred years ago, we would have seen a lot more use of these aromatic plants. Flowers would have been brought in probably at every Sunday for ceremony, and these flowers would have had strong smells. And what I noticed is that a lot of the plants that I use in clinic, like skullcap or lemon balm or lavender, that are used to help with depression or anxiety or both, also have really strong smells. And when I put this together with the understanding that humans have been using strongly scented plants in ceremony forever, and looking at the way these plants work in the human body, I kind of came to the understanding that this is one of the key areas, one of those three key hubs of activity in the human body, that we really have relied on plants to help modulate forever and ever. And that's the reason we use them in ceremony. That's the reason we bring them into funeral celebrations. The basic bottom line is that aromatic plants bring us into the present moment and help us focus on the flow of change and the flow of events that are happening at this particular moment in time. They do it in two basic ways. First of all, the smell. You smell these plants, they immediately get your attention. There's no way to cut off a smell. You definitely are going to become aware of it. And the second thing is that once your attention is grabbed by the smell, if you actually consume these volatile oil-rich plants internally, they have this two-phase effect on every smooth muscle in our body, meaning the muscles that line our gut, the muscles that line our arteries, even the heart muscle itself. And they help to give it a little bit of a stimulus if it's feeling underactive or sluggish, and then relax it if it's feeling overly tight. And it's really neat to see when you look at the pharmacology of these plants, how they first have this stimulating effect and then they have this relaxing effect. So it's kind of like pushing the reset button on the level of tension inside you. bringing it up and stimulating things if you're underactive or sluggish, and then relaxing it if you're feeling overly tense. So you couple that with the, you know, attention-grabbing effect of the smell, and you then add this sort of relaxing, rebalancing reset to the inner level of tension, then all the stuff from the outside world has a whole heck of a lot less impact. So I use these plants not only for ongoing mental health support, but also, you know, at the end of the day when I pick up my daughter and it's time to kind of do some work at home or some playtime at home and I need to change from work mode to family mode, or when I might put my daughter to sleep and it's time to sit down and maybe do some writing or preparing for the next day's classes, I will use a cup of linden tea, for instance, and it will get me right into that present moment, right into that creative flow. And that's one of the things I see that bugs people a lot, you know. They will have a hard time adapting to change. They'll feel uncreative or sort of depressed and sluggish, or at the same time they'll feel frazzled or anxious or overly stressed out. And this is the great gift that aromatics can give us, is they can really help adjust our mental health, which is a huge, I think, really important part of the problems that we see with Western culture. And again, you know, this is the point I try to make over and over in the book. Human beings are incredible adaptive organisms. I think we're really awesome beings that are very strong. But in order to be at our peak, we really need to be able to be connected to these non-food-like wild medicinal plants that have been a part of our culture in the form of aromatics in church, for instance. But also, you know, for thousands of years. And we've, you know, unfortunately not been using them quite so much over the last couple hundred years. And I think that's part of why we see so many issues. So I'll use a cup of linden tea as my go-to aromatic a lot of the times. But other people prefer, you know, some peppermint after a meal to kind of relax and relieve some indigestion or tension in the belly. People will use lemon balm a lot of the times as a way to help during winter months when we feel a little more lack of joy and lack of spark and just the dreariness of, you know, a January rain. And then even things like roses, and we make a great rose elixir that can really help with sadness or broken heart. Another aromatic that I really love is something like ginger, which is great for sort of the underactive, uncreative, unstimulated person to kind of wake things up a little bit and spice things up a little bit. And the great thing about all those these aromatics is that they help with mental health without interacting with pharmaceuticals the way something like St. John's wort or kava kava, both great herbs, but way more potent and way more dangerous in terms of interaction with some of the conventional meds. So aromatics are safe. They rebalance tension internally. They grab our attention with their smells. They make a great, delicious cup of tea, and you can use them for stimulating creativity and adding spark to your life, or also for relaxing tension and anxiety in a really, really safe way.
So how do they work when you because we know from ancient medicines, for instance, like I know in Ayurveda, which I've studied extensively, different scents have different energetics. For instance, if you feel mm-hmm. like you use the January dreariness analogy, you know, that's kind of like a excess weight and heaviness, more of a kapha presentation. And, you know, you would
right.
use things like eucalyptus or mint to energize it. But actually, you know, they didn't really know about molecules and the receptor sites. So what's the biochemistry of the aromatics on our brain and on our olfactory system?
Yeah, so I mean that's a great and rich question, and I do go into that in the aromatics chapter
right.
pretty extensively. But I think you bring up the really good point that a healing system like Ayurveda, right, had this figured out probably 3 or maybe even 4,000 years before, you know, we're having this conversation about molecules today, and they assigned energies or sometimes temperatures to these plants.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, researchers are starting to figure this out. It's really interesting. I just read a piece of research last week that compared hot and cold classifications of Chinese herbs to their interaction pathways of affecting enzymes inside cells. And they generally found a consistent difference between plants that had been labeled as hot and plants that had been labeled as cold in terms of their molecular interaction network inside cells. So that's why I love herbal medicine,
yeah,
right?
You'll have to send me that paper.
Got this,
You'll have to send me that paper or reference. I'd like to read that.
Oh, definitely. If you give me a sec, I'll pull it up in a little bit. But the point that you bring up, that you know you would use something stimulating like eucalyptus or peppermint to help deal with a sluggish kapha situation, and you might use something a little more relaxing like sesame or maybe even linden in the case of you know a more vata anxiety presentation.
Right.
Is really good. And the neat thing, though, is that if you use aromatic plants, a lot of times you can have this double effect because of the way they work on tissue. So the aromatic plants work in two basic ways. The first is directly through smell, through the olfactory bulb. They actually increase the level of neurotransmission in the area of the brain known as the limbic system that is involved with processing emotion, but also involved with sort of accessing our library of stored memories from the frontal lobe and integrating it into the present moment. You know, so when we're getting involved in a task and we need to recall a memory and apply it to the task at hand and then alter the way we move and work in our thought pattern, all of that is frontal lobe connecting to limbic system, connecting back to frontal lobe and then affecting, you know, cortical function and getting us to make decisions or move in a certain direction. So first of all, the actual activation of the olfactory bulb and the stimulation of the limbic system is a great way to just get that system online and active and present. So we're not kind of like lost in our thinking pattern. We're more directly focused on present, what we call executive function. And all the aromatic plants, when they've been researched, from lavender, which would be considered cool and calming, to ginger, which would be considered hot, right? They improve executive function when they're given to people for sort of attention-based tasks, you know, like Simon Says type memory games, clinical research. Then when the constituents get into the body, there's this two-phase effect. At first, a lot of the volatile oils, and you know this, you know, if you've ever used tea tree oil pure on your skin, for a lot of people that can be too irritating, right? It'll cause a little redness.
Right.
It's irritating. And that's how it's antiseptic. That's how it kills stuff. It just melts away the protective skin of a bacterium, you know, the plasma membrane of that bug. So at first there's this irritation which causes the muscle to contract a little bit. But then you have this relaxation. And there's a couple of ways where they think these volatile oils work or how they think they work. One is through the blocking of calcium channels a little bit, and calcium is a mineral that's really essential for muscle contraction. So if you block the calcium channel just a little bit, you tend to cause a little muscle relaxation. And the other is through activation of this secondary messenger inside cells called CAMP or cyclic AMP.
Mm.
And by doing that, you also tend to reduce the amount of contractility or the amount of squeezing that these smooth muscle cells do. And that is, in essence, the way aromatic plants can have both of these effects. They first stimulate, and then they relax. But what's super neat to see is that the plants that have sort of the shorter, smaller molecules in them, like eucalyptol or menthol from eucalyptus and peppermint, they tend to have more of a relaxing effect because these molecules are small, right? And so they don't persist on the tissue very long. So the irritation that they give at first is mild, and then the relaxation predominates. But then, if you use something like ginger that has, you know, a pungent aromatic like gingerol in it, it's a bigger molecule than menthol. It persists on the tissue a little longer, so that initial stimulatory effect is more pronounced than with something like eucalyptus or menthol. And you get a little more sort of contractile stimulus in the muscle before the relaxation ensues. So it's really neat that the chemistry of the plant, and therefore the effect on the tissue, is actually something that, you know, botanical medicine people who practiced Ayurveda, for instance, knew for thousands of years before we figured out that it was connected to the size of the molecule and the sort of cocktail of chemistry of each one of these aromatic plants in particular. Again, that's why I really love herbal medicine. It uses myth and things like temperature or doshas to really explain the way plants work before we even had a biochemical understanding of why they did what they did.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting when people use these plants as inhalation, it can also cement, you know, holographic imprints into the memory areas of our brain. So, for instance, like I've had a lot of my students study for their boards by as they're studying, which they're currently doing now. Many of them are listening now. They have their boards in August. But they would breathe, you know, as they're studying and have their mind really intent on memorizing just a vast amount of information for their naturopathic medical boards, or NPLEX as we call them. They're smelling certain fragrances to kind of cement that information into their brain and using all the five senses to study. And then when it comes time for the boards, they may be able to access that information by smelling those aromatics. Do you ever do that with patients, Guido?
Absolutely, and that's just brilliant, Dr. Z. I really I resonate with that a lot, and that is something that actually human beings have been doing forever. And we all, like, at the very least, can connect the smell of a particular soup, like a chicken noodle soup or something that maybe our parents made when we were young, and you'll smell that out on the street one day, you know, and you'll immediately be transported back to wherever it was that smell was first sort of cemented in your memory. And that's precisely what I was talking about, right? Yeah. When you smell the smell, that executive function center is awakened. So not only your recall of memory, but also your creation of memory and assigning emotional content to that memory, all of that becomes stimulated. And smell is the only sense that doesn't pass through this area of the brain called the thalamus. The thalamus, kind of like, you know, the example I always give is I can look right at my car keys and not see them because the thalamus is censoring that input. It's kind of saying, oh, you don't need to see your car keys right now. But it's impossible to do that with smell. It goes right to these memory-producing and emotion-processing centers of the brain, uncensored. It's you can't turn smell off. And so being able to engage in a process and have a smell associated with that process is a really great way to cement those memories better. Mm. And then, yeah, if you have a little vial of pine essential oil or lavender essential oil that you can bring with you and sort of reawaken that same pathway, you'll have the flood of memory coming back. It's really quite effective, and it actually has been harnessed by cultures for exactly that purpose. Part of the reason we do use certain aromatic plants as incense in certain situations is to associate that particular ecstatic trance or religious spiritual state with that particular smell. It sort of is a cultural way to cement a collective memory that everyone can share, and that smell will be permanently linked to that. And cultures that figured this out has had a huge advantage in terms of being able to reawaken certain memories in certain people. It's very magical, you know. The thing that I mention in the book is that if you know my smells, if you know the smells that reawaken memories in me, you can control my thoughts.
Yeah.
And so, seriously, it's impossible.
Yeah, well, I think people should definitely use that. You know, so, you know, if I have a patient who has anxiety and depressed, after I do some progressive relaxation with them and they're in, and they admit they're feeling very good, I have them smell certain fragrances and I say, okay, now whenever you feel like you're getting uptight and you can read this, you know, the signs in your muscles and your, you know, in your thoughts and whatnot, when things are getting tense, you can put a little of this volatile oil on a handkerchief and, you know, keep it in a baggie so you're not smelling it all the time, and breathe it and use that to transport you back to when you were laying on my table and I was doing cranial sacral therapy on you and you were feeling blissful. Powerful medicine, the aromatics.
Absolutely, and even more so, my contention, if you take a whole plant that is rich with aromatic oils and you consume it internally, because then you get this rebalancing effect on the muscle inside the body that actually creates a more relaxed or more creative state.
How about using them topically? You know, the old Ayurvedic doctors say the skin has no taste buds.
True enough, but it has a lot of pores.
And it's a good way to, it's the biggest organ, so let's use the skin to our advantage.
That's right. And, you know, the the kind of tongue-in-cheek example I make is that you should use your bathtub as a gigantic teacup and steep yourself in it along with aromatic plants.
There you go.
And, you know, the aromatherapists and people who work at spas, they know this really well, and it's a really powerful way to not only get some warmth and relaxation, but also immediately get more of these volatile oils absorbed through this greatest organ in the body, the skin. And another way to do it, if you're feeling, you know, tightness in your neck and shoulders, you probably use this yourself in your practice. We will use hot ginger compresses all the time to kind of create relaxation and reduce inflammation in muscle. It's a very effective way to use these plants also.
I'll use ginger with lobelia and make a compress. But you know what, I'm looking at the time. We have to take a break, and I just want to make sure that folks know that we're interviewing the author, Guido Mase, The Wild Medicine Solution, blending traditional herbal medicine with history, mythology, clinical practice, and recent findings in physiology and biochemistry. And we're going to talk a little bit more about the bitters, one of my most fascinating subjects, teaching a lot about this in herbal medicine. So I can't wait for Guido to tell us about that. And, of course, the tonics. We have to leave room for talking about the great tonic herbs. So let's take a little ID, and we'll be back with more of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Stay with us. And we're back with more of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and we're interviewing Guido Mase, and he is the clinical herbalist, herbal educator, garden steward. Now, you're up in Vermont, Guido, at the Vermont Center for Integrated Herbalism. Tell us a little bit about that before we get back into the book.
Yeah, so the Vermont Center for Integrative Herbalism is a 501c3 nonprofit that I founded along with a couple of colleagues in 2007. This was kind of an outgrowth of the clinical work and teaching work that I'd been doing since about 2003. And we decided that we wanted to offer herbal services directly to the public in a nonprofit way, and also on a sliding scale. It starts at $0 to try and bring herbal medicine into the community and get around the fact that there's really no insurance coverage outside of, you know, going and consulting with a naturopathic physician, for instance, for botanical medicine. And so we educate students in a 3-year clinical herbal training program here, but we also see clients on a one-on-one basis and help educate them about these great wild plants that are growing all around us. They're ridiculously easy to get into your garden alongside your tomatoes, and also how to use plants like basil, which are great aromatic plants for things like headaches and tension, as well as leaving your dandelions in your garden to get the benefit of some of their bitter quality.
That's a great segue to talk a little bit about bitters. It's so fascinating, you know, and I have fond and not so fond childhood memories of my father.
Tell me about it.
My father is from Venice, and he would drink his Fernet Branca, and which was kind of from his region, and drink this god-awful bitter stuff. That's what we used to think of when we were kids. Say, why is he drinking this? And he would say, well, it would make his awaken his stomach, so he was able to digest often his huge quantity of food that he would consume. So, and then we would try a swig of this stuff and just be kind of grotesque. But, you know, you have this wonderful chapter on bitters here, and you know the bitter taste. I mean, if you take a bitter and a sweet and give it to an infant, they'll be attracted to the sweet, but yet bitters have huge role in our culture. Tell us a little bit about the chapter, how it's written. Tell us a little about your experience with bitters and some of the background information about using bitters.
Well, I try to frame the chapter around the story of this king from 2,000 years ago, who ruled sort of what's now present-day Turkey, right at the time when the Roman Empire was trying to invade his lands. And this guy sort of was super paranoid, thinking that he was going to get poisoned, you know, every other day, which certainly was a hazard of the time if you were any kind of member of the ruling elite. And so he tried to develop this antidote to poison, a way to kind of like buffer any kind of toxicity that might be introduced into his life. And he focused on a couple of things, a little bit of the aromatic plants for sure, which were always considered sacred and important, but primarily the bitter plants, things like gentian root and artichoke leaf and centaury. And he did this because he found that a lot of the poisons tasted really, really bitter. And if you selected some of these bitter plants like artichoke leaf, which are not at all poisonous but taste a lot like deadly nightshade, like belladonna, for instance, then his thought was, well, if it tastes like bitter, maybe it will stimulate the anti-bitter effect of my body and or the anti-poison effect of my body and help buffer any toxicity that is thrown into my evening meal. And, you know, he was absolutely right about that. And it's really, I think, a great story to kind of frame the importance of the bitter taste. And as you said, you know, kids, if you give them a chance, they're going to go straight for the sweet every time. Also, if you tell kids, you know, we're going to go for a 10-mile run or we're going to sit on the couch and watch TV, they would probably choose sitting on the couch, right, except for maybe the most sort of active and special child. But generally speaking, that's, you know, humans, we've worked ourselves to the bone for thousands of years. We've been forced to eat, you know, what we can glean, what we can find, the sort of rough, bitter, coarse food. So when the Industrialized Revolution gave us the promise of, you know, sitting around and not using our bodies every day because machines would do our work for us, and eating sweet cake every night at the end of our, you know, sedentary work day, we took that and ran with it like a little kid would. Who wouldn't, you know? We've since realized that moving your body is actually a pretty important part of being human, that not exercising is not good for us. But we haven't made that connection to the fact that tasting bitterness is also really important. The bitter is the, just like you said, you know, my dad did the same thing. He would give us these things like Chinar or Fernet to try when we were kids, and it was god-awful bitter stuff. But that's exactly it. You know, it wakes up your digestion. And a lot of the symptoms of digestive issues that people have from our processed food really come to the fact that that processed food doesn't have any bitterness whatsoever mixed in with it anymore, because we're all trying to cater to our little kid palate. Right. And so adding these bitters in, which have been a huge part of sort of any culture, especially European cultures, is a great way to be able to still enjoy a lot of the foods that the modern world has to offer, but not see the bloating and indigestion and, frankly, inflammation that this Western diet causes.
Well, it turns out that lots of things that are bitter are kill microbes, so that's very interesting, first of all. And somewhat, we've associated bitters with poisonous things. I think even animals tend to do that. Many of the alkaloids and
absolutely,
some of the iridoid glycosides, you know, for those that understand botanical chemistry, are extremely bitter, some of the sesquiterpenes. So, and being that we're hardwired to get rid of the bitter, and maybe our ancestors watched animals stay away from bitter things because they were associated with poison, it's fascinating how we began to use in history to go back to the bitters and realize what powerful medicines they were for digestion, for killing parasites, and also other I'm sure other things, reducing inflammation and whatnot, because it turns out the bitter things are most powerful anti-inflammatories for the most part.
Yeah, they're essential. And, you know, just to go back to what you were saying, you know, most bitter things are actually things that plants evolved to keep insects from eating them.
Mm.
And they're insecticides. They're poisons to insects. But what mammals did is, you know, mammals evolved these livers. And we have livers that basically take these many of these bitter substances and completely detoxify them, rendering them somewhat harmless. And the problem, though, is that, you know, we evolved in the context of consistently eating these substances, and now we've effectively removed that context from our diet. So now we're the only mammal in history who has this big liver that is kind of waiting in the wings to kind of do its job with these bitter molecules, but there's no bitter molecules coming in because our diet has completely removed them. So in essence, the liver's detoxifying power is now left unused or untapped. And a lot of the chemistry that is harming us, from pesticide residues onto plasticizers and other things that we find in our environment, could be effectively neutralized if only we woke the liver up with the things that it was built to handle, which are these bitter compounds. And once you reintroduce them, the liver begins to work a lot better at processing everything from our environment that could be harmful to us, which is why, bottom line, in Europe, they still use this very bitter root, gentian root, for dealing with allergies, seasonal allergies and chemical sensitivities. They're great anti-inflammatories because they work on our own detoxifying system, the liver. And just really quickly, my sort of major selling point for bitters is that it really helps control our craving for sugar and carbohydrate. If you feel a craving for carbohydrate, tasting something bitter will immediately help control that. And a lot of clients that I work with that are trying to get on carbohydrate restriction diets or reframe their relationship to sugar are helped immensely by just introducing something like dandelion root into their diet again.
Now, you mentioned the T2R receptors. Talk a little bit about the physiology of bitters.
Yeah, so we got all sorts of receptors on our tongue for, protein, the umami flavor, for fatty acids, for sweet, and for salty, the sodium ion, for the hydrogen ion, for sour, and especially for bitter. Now, all the other receptors except the T2R receptor, they're coded for by three or four genes, and they can recognize one or two substances. But the bitter taste receptor is coded for by a complex of 40 different genes, and it can recognize over 100 different bitter tastant molecules. It's extremely sensitive, and it's sort of the front doorbell of the digestive system. It's there to kind of activate all of our detoxification and digestive machinery. And that's why tasting the bitter with something like a Fernet, as an aperitif, is really the way to go. You're not going to get the same effect by eating a dandelion root capsule. Actually tasting it in liquid form is pretty essential. But once you do that, because the tongue, is a very, very sensitive structure that has a lot of nerve endings connected to it, that ringing of the front doorbell then hits the rest of the digestive tract, and stomach and acid is balanced, pancreatic enzyme secretion is increased, liver activity is awakened, the gallbladder begins to secrete more bile from its stores into the digestive tract, sort of like primes the pump. You start to see an increased secretion of insulin into the bloodstream. So post-eating, post-prandial blood sugar spikes are controlled. It's really amazing what you do by just tasting this bitter on the tongue because of the sophistication of this bitter T2R receptor.
So people should, when they're trying to lose weight or if they have diabetes, they should be using the bitters as not only something to help them digest the food, but also slow down the entry of sugar in the bloodstream, and then they eat less.
You got it. You got it. Wow. And now we're also particularly keen on the state of the gut flora, the microbes that are in our digestive tract. And what's really neat is that bitters also often contain, in their whole form, a large proportion of these beneficial starches, like oligosaccharides, that are really useful for nourishing the gut flora and balancing and the sort of combination of microbes that are in our colon. That might be another big part of why they can really help with inflammation. But absolutely true for weight loss, for diabetes, a little bit of bitters before you eat. The study that I quote is one where they found that when you sit people in front of an all-you-can-eat buffet, if you give half of them a bitter taste before they eat, about 5-10 minutes before they eat, they will consume about 30% less.
Wow, that's a great study. That's a wonderful study.
And
what's interesting, too? Even though many people have switched to stevia and Truvia as a sugar substitute, which is great, it doesn't spike up the blood sugar, but still, just tasting the sweet taste of the stevia and Truvia with their meal seems to make them eat more versus if they took a shot of bitters or chewed on a couple dandelion leaves, even though it's non-caloric and doesn't have any sweet to it. In other words, it's not glucose or sucrose or things like that.
That's right. And I mean, because what's the stevia doing? It's awakening the sweet reward centers of the brain. It's like a shot of cocaine to the brain, basically. Mm. Whereas the bitter is kind of saying, like, whoa, slow down, don't eat as much.
And it's fascinating, fascinating that there's more connections to the brain with the bitter receptors than the other receptors. That may be really important in the way that we're supposed to eat, I think. Maybe because we're more hardwired for bitters. See, that kind of flies in the face of our innateness with the example I gave when you give the infant the bitter versus the sweet. Maybe sweetness was more for survival or something like that, and it seems like a stronger... What's your thinking on that?
Sweetness was rare. So anytime we found sweetness, you know, out in the bush, the brain said, well done, whatever you find, go right back to it, eat as much of it as you can while you can.
Fighting off the hordes of bees and things like that.
Yeah, do whatever you can to get more of that, because we were starving for nutrition all the time. Whereas now, sweet is available at every corner gas station, and it's the bitter that's totally missing. And bitter was what was there every single day. And we needed to be able to sophisticatedly discriminate between something that was bitter and was okay and something was so bitter that it was probably poison. So that's why the receptor is so sensitive and sophisticated. And I think you're absolutely right. We're built for bitters. And again, human beings are awesome, resilient, strong animals. And I would really blame the lack of bitter more than the ubiquitous presence of sugar when we're talking about the diabetes epidemic, when we're talking about the obesity epidemic. And that's why I call it, you know, the mild medicine solution in part, because bringing those bitters in is a huge way to get a handle on it, something positive that you can do rather than just restricting sugar, which is really hard for a lot of folks.
So that, see, folks, you can, and then Guido gives some recipes on, you know, how to go out and dig up your dandelions or certainly gather the leaves or just don't allow them to grow, you know, with your other vegetables, and certainly there's a lot of vegetables that people use that are bitter. Broccoli rabe, for example, is a good one that they could have in their garden.
You got it, or radicchio.
Exactly. So we're running out of time, so we have to talk a little bit about tonics, because I want you to then wrap up. So we got about maybe 5 minutes on the tonics, and then we should do a little bit of a wrap-up.
Yeah, so the tonics, I divide them into sweet and sour categories, and the sweet tonics are herbs like astragalus or even the medicinal mushrooms, and they have this amazing way to talk to our immune system. So we use these types of sweet tonics for chronic inflammation, autoimmune inflammation, like problems associated with rheumatoid arthritis or lupus, because of the way they can talk to immunity. And we're starting to see that just like with going only with sugar, as our diet, when you put a kid in a completely sterile environment and you do the work of the immune system for it by prescribing antibiotics all the time, you basically create a dysfunctional immune response. One of the best pieces of research, it's now a research body, you know, there's a lot of evidence for this, is that kids who grew up on farms have much lower rates of asthma and allergies than kids who grew up in sterile environments in cities, because this immune dysfunction takes place. So the solution to this isn't necessarily for everyone to go out and live on the farm. It's to bring in some of these sweet tonics, like the ones found from astragalus root and the medicinal mushrooms. These have this amazing rebalancing effect on our immune response, also if it's underactive and people get sick all the time. So for allergies, asthma, autoimmune disease, but also for low immunity, frequent infection, frequent respiratory problems. And then we've got the sour tonics. And, you know, the best example of this, I think, is the blueberry, but also hawthorn berry is a fantastic example. These are all plants that are rich in polyphenols, particularly molecules like bioflavonoids. They're also found in the white part of the orange. They're found in all citrus fruits, definitely almost all berries, cranberries, blueberries, raspberries, hawthorn berries, even in apples and onions to a certain extent. All of these are bioflavonoid polyphenol molecules, and they have this amazing effect deep, deep down in every single cell of our body. They coordinate the way the genome, the DNA in our cells, expresses itself, turning it away from pro-inflammatory, pro-cancer. It helps turn off cancer-causing genes, oncogenes, turn on self-destruct switches in the case of cancerous cells, but also reduce inflammation. And so the net result of this is cancer prevention, but also cardiovascular disease prevention. And so you hit this number one killer in the Western world, which is heart disease, by consuming these bioflavonoid polyphenol-rich berries on a daily basis. And again, you know, if someone's had, you know, three heart attacks and they're on the way to their fourth and their diet is horrible and they don't move their body, is hawthorn berry going to, you know, turn back the clock 40 years? Probably not. It still would be a good idea. But what we need to do is get these tonics into our life on a daily basis. Part of the reason, again, that we're seeing so much cardiovascular disease in this culture is because of an absence of these things that human beings would be foraging on and eating every single day for all of their life since they were little kids. And to me, it's the tonics are an amazing, tangible, visible reminder that we are connected to the botanical world as animals, as human beings. Without these signal molecules, these bioflavonoids, getting into our bodies, our DNA doesn't know what to do. Just like our liver doesn't know what to do unless there's these bitter tastings that we have on our tongue. Our genome gets screwed up in the way it expresses itself, and we see inflammation happening much more easily. We see immune dysfunction happening much more easily. But if you bring these plants back into life as soon as you possibly can on a daily habitual basis, it's really easy to do. You know, a quarter cup of frozen blueberries a day, you're putting in the signal molecules that help your genes unfold and create your physical being in a much more balanced, much less inflamed way. So you get at the root, I think, of the cardiovascular disease epidemic in this.
You also mentioned chocolate as one of these tonics. That's kind of a new one for many listeners out there.
You know, chocolate is one of the most polyphenol bioflavonoid-rich products that we can find in the mainstream grocery store today.
Wow.
But I really suggest making sure that it's at least 70% dark chocolate to get its beneficial effects. And, you know, half a dark chocolate bar a day, there you go. That is heart medicine right there, and it's not too hard to take either.
And it has its bitter nature, too, you know. As long as you don't sweeten it, you could cook with chocolate, you know, make nice Mexican food with the chocolate, like a mole sauce and things like that.
You got it.
Use it as the kitchen. And
yep.
It's interesting,
and
they used to cook with astragalus, too. The Chinese would always put astragalus in chicken soup.
Dr. Z, exactly, and it's super easy to do. The stuff is really cheap. It's also really easy to grow if you feel like you're inclined to grow something. And you just chop it up and you put it in your soup. It doesn't alter the flavor, and you can cook it with your bones into a beautiful stock or with your vegetables. And then you really get the benefit of this sort of immune-balancing, immune-enhancing root.
And one of my students did his thesis on mushrooms, medicinal mushrooms, and he pointed out some very ancient use of mushrooms, that they would find mushrooms as a protein source in very early human existence. So it seems like, again, we've co-evolved with the mushrooms. And I know people, all they do is they eat the little mushrooms they get in the produce department. They don't. There's a huge variety of mushrooms to eat.
There sure are, and then there's other ones that you can add into stock and simmer, like reishi mushroom. And, you know, just going back to an old example, they dug up this guy from a glacier, Ötzi, the Iceman, right, out of the middle of the Alps, and it seemed like he'd been shot by an arrow, and he had a little bit of an infection. So what was he carrying with him in his pouch? They found all these medicinal mushrooms that he was using to strengthen his immune system.
Amazing. Well, tell us a little bit in the last minute or so about where we can get your book and how we can get in touch with you.
Yeah, so the book is called The Wild Medicine Solution, and it's definitely on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com and at a lot of local independent booksellers as well, which you can find on IndieBounds.com. See if your local bookstore carries it. And it's pretty affordable, I think, at Amazon. It's less than $15. And what I would love to see is folks just – incorporating one bitter plant, one aromatic plant, and maybe a tonic plant into their life on a daily basis, and doing it in a way that connects them to the outside world. You know, even if it just means digging up some dandelion roots in the spring and steeping them in vodka to make a very simple tincture or tonic. If we'll do that, then we'll see that over, you know, the course of a few days, a few weeks, a few months, and the culture as a whole, bringing these plants back in will be a huge part of the solution that brings us forward as a species and helps get a handle on some of the chronic diseases of the Western diet. I teach this at the Vermont Center for Integrative Herbalism. We have a 3-year clinical herbalist training program there. We collaborate with local physicians, helping to bring herbal medicine into the modern healthcare team, which is such an important part, along with nutrition and exercise, of making people healthy, happy, and whole. And again, you know, Western medicine is fantastic. It makes us work, but I really believe botanical medicine and nutrition is what makes us well.
And great, so, and we hope to get you down maybe to Connecticut to lecture at the University of Bridgeport. It would be really fascinating to have you down there and invite you down there.
Yeah, it's the premier naturopathic college on the East Coast, so that's great.
Okay, well, stay in touch, and thank you for your wonderful book and work. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Dr. Z. It was a pleasure.
All right, thank you. And that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Stay tuned right here to Progressive Radio Network for the best in radio. Bye-bye, and stay healthy.